SAP Concur does what might seem impossible for your business. It makes employees happy and finance happy. How? Well, employees love automated expense claims and invoices they can submit and approve from anywhere. And finance loves that they have full visibility into employee spend. Plus, SAP Concur integrates with leading finance systems, making the process better for everyone. SAP Concur. Expense, travel, invoice. Learn more at concur.co.uk.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. Karen Everett is one of the world's leading documentary story consultants, as well as an award-winning documentary filmmaker. As the founder of New Doc Editing LLC, she's helped hundreds of filmmakers structure transformational documentaries for PBS, HBO, Sundance, and other top film festivals. Her business, New Doc Editing, provides directors with talented documentary editors as well as story consultants. Karen is the author of the book Documentary Editing, and has directed and produced six of her own documentaries, including the award-winning PBS biography, I Shall Not Be Removed, The Life of Marlon Riggs, and American Visionary, The Story of Barbara Marx Hubbard. She can be reached through her email, karen@newdocediting.com. And Carol, I understand that Karen has edited many of your fiscally sponsored films.
Yeah, Claire, Karen's done an excellent job for our filmmakers, and we thank you so much, Karen, for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you, Claire and Carol, for having me on.
Well, we're going to cover a lot of things today. We want to cover how documentaries are scripted in the edit room, why character-driven docs are so popular, and some of the biggest mistakes that filmmakers make. So to get started, I thought that I know you've helped hundreds of filmmakers structure their films. So let's start with some of those success stories.
Okay. Well, I just, because your nonprofit, Carol, is called From the Heart Productions, I'm going to start by saying how much I adore you and love you. And one of the success stories is my own film, which I don't need to get into, but you did help me raise $125,000 for that film. You were my ardent cheerleader the whole way, and I am so grateful for your help. And I just want to tell you, I love you.
Oh, how sweet of you, Karen, because thank you very much. I know that. I remember I would just take the phone out of the office to the porch so I could get really outside because I had to focus. You wanted $100,000, and we knew that it was what you needed, and the question was how to get there. And what's so good about working with you is that you listened very carefully. You heard everything I said and suggested. And the next call we would have, you would have done it. And we were moving forward at rapid speed. So thank you for that. We did have a lot of fun raising that money up. From my side, I was so proud of you.
Thank you. Thank you. And some of the success stories, let me just mention a couple of films and filmmakers that I've met through you. Bonnie Rich, whose personal documentary, Life is Rich, was just nominated for an audience award, and Leanne Dance's film, My Dear Children, about Jewish pogroms, was sold to American Public Television, helping Anita Castellana. Yep. Anita's making a promising documentary about racial healing circles. And, you know, I was just, I'm getting ready to give my website a big facelift. So I was going through, over 200 films that I've worked on in the last 10 years, and I counted 37 documentaries that had had won more than one award. So 37 award-winning documentaries. One won an Emmy. Two were nominated for an Emmy. And I want to focus just for a second on one of those Emmy-nominated films. It was made by director Steve Pressman. He took my class directing the character-driven documentary, which I taught at the San Francisco Film Institute for several years. And he made a film about an American Jewish couple in the 1940s who went about trying to save children at risk under the Nazi occupation. And it's called 50 Children, The Rescue Mission of Mr. and Mrs. Krauss. And we worked hard to shape that into a dramatic three-act structure. And the reason this film is a success story to me is not only did it air on HBO, which is hard to do and was wonderful, but that film, as you can probably tell from the title, is a terrific example of the kind of inspiring and solution-oriented documentaries that I think we're all so hungry for these days.
Yes, solution-oriented.
And I was very proud of it.
Oh, yes. Solution-oriented is the right word, because I watch so many docs, Karen. The worst thing that happens to me is when I watch a documentary and it's over and I'm totally depressed and I'm thinking, oh, my God, how are we ever going to solve this problem, you know? And I feel sad, and I don't want to feel that way. I want to feel, okay, I see the problem and I see the solution.
Yeah, yeah. In 2014, Actually, when I left teaching the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley in 2012, part of the reason I left to start my own consulting business, I mean, it was the top documentary program in the country, but the whole focus on journalism then and to some degree certainly now is on what's not working. And so I started blogging about the need for a new kind of documentary that not only pointed out what wasn't working and left us feeling depleted at the end, and I think we needed those for a while to wake up, but a genre of films that I call transformational documentaries, but they're solution-oriented films that don't shy away from social issues and ultimately leave viewers feeling optimistic. And I recently noticed in the NEA's 2017 report from their Documentary Sustainability Summit, they're calling for more open and solution-oriented approaches to filmmaking. I think we're waking up to that need. It's very exciting. Yeah.
Yes, that is exciting, because then you feel like you're part of a group all those people who have seen it, there is hope, because if everybody chips in and does whatever they're told or suggested, then you feel like you're doing your part. I like that.
Yeah, and a lot of those films like The Cove and An Inconvenient Truth, Waiting for Superman, they end with a call to action. And, you know, a lot of directors might feel like, well, I don't want to tell my viewer how to act, but people, you don't have to do that. You can invite, and people do appreciate having, especially with a social issue documentary, some suggestion of what to do. A lot of the films that the directors you've referred me to, they do spend more screen time on the solution than the problem. And I think we both have that sensibility of kind of guiding them to do that. I remember Kathy Sparnan's film Voices of Grief, which is about death and dying and grieving. And it doesn't wallow in the problem of, you know, we live in a culture where people, you're not allowed enough time to grieve. That film offers fresh perspectives on the many ways we can, this is actually right off their website, we can navigate successfully through great grief.
Yes.
So, they also thinking of Anita Castellaneta's film about racial healing circles. It's going, you know, it's we're working on it now. She's in production. It spends more time focusing on healing from racism than suffering from racism. And again, it's not to undermine the problem, but to give people hope that there's something we can do about these problems.
Absolutely right. Yes, this is great. And you've chosen, all of those people are lovely to work with, so I'm very glad that you're helping them with their films. They're all important.
Thank you.
They? Yeah.
They really are. Yeah.
Well, okay, let's get back to, let's talk about what's one of the biggest mistakes that filmmakers make when that you see from your angle.
Well, it's the biggest mistake is that directors overshoot because they're not clear on their vision and the structure.
Yeah.
And I know I've fallen into this on at least two of my documentaries, which have more than 200 hours of footage each. And the problem is when you have that much footage, and shooting is exciting and fun, and filmmakers have a lot of energy at that stage. But then you've got to spend weeks and usually months and sometimes years logging all that footage. And that can bring the whole endeavor to a standstill. You lose sight of the film you wanted to make. Filmmakers sometimes become stuck. It's often a stage at which filmmakers seek me out for story consulting because they've lost perspective. And the solution to that problem is first to really see your film as clearly as possible before you shoot, and then shoot judiciously. And when I was teaching at UC Berkeley at the Graduate School of Journalism, the director of the program there, John Else, gave we usually had 10 students at a time. He gave them 10 days of shooting for a 24-minute film. And that discipline forced them to think carefully about, you know, what scenes do I need? And sort of, it was like an antidote to this tendency to use, he had the phrase, don't use the camera like a fire hose in hopes of capturing something wonderful.
This is great. Yeah. You know, Karen, back in the time when video was really starting to take off, maybe back to around the year 1999, 2000, I was very close to Kodak because I sold raw stock, you know, short ends. And one of the Kodak men told me, he said, you know, the biggest problem, Carol, they're going to have is that they think they're going to move from shooting 3-to-1, 4-to-1 ratio with film because of the cost.
Uh-huh.
Now they're going to be shooting 20-to-30-to-1. And this is what's going to happen. The biggest problem is going to be in the editing room. And that's exactly what you're saying. 18 years later, we're looking at the problem.
You're exactly right. And, you know, what do you do if you already have that 200 hours? You know,
yes.
How do you get through that? And that's, you know, part of the reason editing is the most expensive part of documentary filmmaking is because it takes so long. So we've developed a program called Accelerated Post that help solve that problem of taking so long to get through editing. And the first thing we do is help filmmakers get that, whatever they've shot, 80 hours, 200 hours, down to 30 hours of their best footage. And they turn that over to our editor. And we, our sort of claim to fame is that we can edit a film in 10 weeks. And,
wow.
You know, it used to take, typically it can take 6 to 12 months to edit a feature documentary. So, you know, we help filmmakers figure out how to get through all that footage and log it quickly. A big part of that is just being very clear on the criteria for you select. It's
yes.
Either got to be plot based or, you know, hit one of the big themes if you're making an essay style film.
Right.
So, I do think that is, it goes back to that biggest problem of overshooting.
Overshooting. So that's one of the biggest mistakes they make. And so you're saying that to really get clear, see the film clearly, and then go shoot. Know what you want and aim for that and try to get it within a certain amount of footage so that you can log it all and have a short edit, not be in there forever, right?
Exactly. And when I help filmmakers in pre-production or production stage, a lot of our focus is on, figuring out what is the important juice that you want to contribute to a certain conversation, and what's the best way to capture that on camera? Is it through a story? a story being defined, like screenwriters define it, as a character who's on a quest to achieve something. And those kinds of documentaries are very popular these days. Or is it more of an essay doc, meaning it's structured around ideas? And if so, who's going to articulate those ideas? And also, how can you bring little elements of story into what could be a dry talking head topic-driven film? And they're sort of our claim to fame, I guess, as a business is goes back to our tagline, which is keeping viewers glued to the screen. And the way to do that, number one would be making a character-driven film. But if that's not the kind of film you want to make, you can still take little bits of dramatic principles and, like Michael Moore does often, include little character anecdotes to bring emotion into your film and to illustrate the ideas that you're explaining. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I know you've taught a lot of sold-out classes on character-driven documentaries. So what distinguishes these kinds of documentaries from others, and why are they so popular, Karen?
Good questions, and I love talking about this because character-driven films became popular, gosh, it's almost 30 years now. 1994 was Hoop Dreams, one of the first documentaries about following two kids on a dream to become professional basketball players. It was one of the first docs to make money at theaters, and these days, character-driven docs are winning awards at festivals. They're getting picked up for broadcasts. And what distinguishes them, it's not only that they have strong characters, but technically speaking, there's at least one character who is a protagonist, meaning they're after something. So I encourage filmmakers to think like screenwriters and to paraphrase one of the great screenwriting gurus, Sid Fields. He says, a story is about someone who wants something badly, and that something has to be difficult to get or achieve. So character-driven films they're sort of inherently interesting because we all relate to the concept of desire, you know, whether it's desire for love or for money or financial security or for health, desire for justice. And so when we see someone on an endeavor for something worthy in the face of obstacles, we are immediately drawn in, we're empathetic, and I encourage filmmakers to follow a classic dramatic structure, the three-act structure. Character-driven documentaries can give a lot of thanks to Aristotle, who designed this with an uncanny understanding of human emotion. Just very briefly to get a little bit into the three-act structure, the first quarter of the film in Act 1, you introduce us to the characters and launch the protagonist's quest, usually with something called an inciting incident. So an example might be a medical diagnosis. Thinking of a film called Sexy Crazy Cancer, I think I got that right. So this young woman is diagnosed with liver cancer, and she sets out on a quest to heal. And then the second act, which is usually the longest, we see that protagonist going after their goal. And that's maybe 60% of the film where they face obstacles. And then the shortest act, the third act, calls for some kind of supreme effort where we find out if they reach their goal or not. So that three-act structure it's a template, but it's very flexible, and it can be modified to documentaries. It's great to be a screenwriter and have the flexibility to make things, but it takes a certain I've developed certain tactics to help filmmakers, for example, create an inciting incident. So this is, again, the event that launches the protagonist's goal. One of the films I worked on a couple years ago, it was about an activist in a Ukrainian young man who is an activist investigating a cover-up at Chernobyl, the nuclear explosion. And the filmmaker lacked an inciting incident. So we went back and found one. And usually by the time documentary filmmakers find a film, the inciting incident has already happened and nobody filmed it. And Hollywood has this rule that this is such an important dramatic device, like it's a catalyst event, that it has to appear, unfold on camera. So anyway, we figured out how to do that, and the film ended up winning the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance for World Documentaries. And Variety magazine called the editing superb. And I'd like to bring that up as just an example of how we can adapt screenwriting principles to documentaries and make them more watchable. So that's a character-driven.
That is so important. Thank you very much. You've outlined it so carefully. You know, one of my favorite screenwriters is Blake Snyder, and his book, Save the Cat. And what he says in his book is that unbeknownst to all of us moviegoers, we are programmed. If we don't get that inciting incident within the first 5 minutes, there's something off. And if something doesn't happen at 20 minutes, and usually that's when the love interest comes up, and 45 minutes is the change. There's a second half of the film that's totally different than the first. If these things, plus more in his book, don't happen, you start to squirm in your seat saying there's something wrong. I don't know if I like this film or not, because you are used to all of these things. So to bring that to the documentaries will make so much sense to me, Karen.
Absolutely. What does Save the Cat refer to, his title? How does that recall?
It's about the character. It's the character, Save the Cat,
okay.
Because he starts off and says that you can judge the character of the film. You should be able to get the character of your, the man you're going to follow in the film, all right? You should be able to get that person's character within the first 2 or 3 minutes. It could be the protagonist, because he said it like in HUD, all you have to do is take a look at the still shot of the actor that was playing HUD, and you've got it. You know what that character is going to be. And he gave us an incident in a film where De Niro is a cop, and he is all these thieves are coming to a meeting, but they don't know that the police are the ones who set the meeting up. So they're all showing up, and this man walked with his son. And when De Niro saw him, he flashed his badge and said, "I'll catch you another day." And the man grabbed his son and left. So we knew immediately this is a heartfelt man.
So... In that case, is he the cat, or is I'm thinking of the
ahead. Cat short for character.
Okay.
Save the character.
Yeah, it's reminding me, and maybe this is where it came from. There's some famous comedian whose name I don't remember has said, I'm paraphrasing, Act One is about chasing your character up a tree. Act Two is about getting them out on a limb.
Yes.
And Act
yes.
Three is about saving them before the tree branch breaks. So maybe that's where that came from.
That's a cat. Exactly. That's right. But it's a catchy title, and everybody says, what does that mean? And when you read the book, you know how important timing is, because we are subconsciously programmed. And the thought of bringing all that programming over to docs, even if it is a subtle shift or a subtle change, is so important. And also, to character development has to be early on, because that's how I decide if I want to watch 90 minutes or not. Do I like the person? Who is this person? So you have a lot to do in that editing room, I'm telling you.
Well, while we're on screenwriting books, I want to mention too very quickly that are written for of course fiction filmmakers, but can be, we specialize in developing ways to adapt this to documentary filmmakers. And if you read these books, I think you'll get some ideas. One is Dara Marks's book, Inside Story, which really has to do with character transformation. Not all documentaries have a character who undergoes some kind of personality change, but often there's a change in belief. On another show, I'll go into the four steps of character transformation. Robert McKee's book, Story, is a classic. I took a seminar from him, and it really helped me develop sort of my work in applying screenwriting techniques for documentary filmmakers.
Oh, I'm sure it did. He's brilliant. I enjoyed his book. You're right. Well, okay, so character-driven are really getting hot. Now, they say that documentaries are scripted in the edit room. So walk me through some of the stages of post-production, please.
Well, films that tend to be more about ideas rather than characters on a quest, I call them essay-style films, they will often start with a paper edit or a script. And let me just say, I've left out the logging stage, which is very important. And the most important thing I'll say about logging is know what criteria you are using to give a thumbs up or thumbs down to a certain soundbite or scene or shot. Because if you don't log well, you're going to spend forever in the edit room. Okay, so paper edit, that basically means you're cutting up your transcripts and coming up with a script on paper. Not always used. The most, and then there's basically four cuts. The first cut is the assembly cut. That's a term not a lot of people are familiar with. We're all familiar with a rough cut. But the assembly cut is your first sort of whack at structure. It's usually 40% of the film's total running time. So if you're eventually making a 100-minute film, the assembly cut might be 140 minutes. It's blocky, it's ugly. You don't show it to anybody outside the film's family. And really, the purpose of the assembly cut is to figure out, A, do we have a film here? And B, what characters do we want to keep or cut? What experts do we want to keep or cut? We don't want any duplicates. And what themes do we focus on? And then the second stage is rough cut. It's about 10% of the final film. A lot of the heavy structural lifting gets done here. Then you have the fine cut, which is maybe 3% of the final film, where you're finessing scenes, and then locked picture. One of the questions I get asked often is, what's the difference between an assembly cut and a rough cut? And I came up with a metaphor I want to share briefly. And maybe you'll appreciate this since you live on the beach. So imagine making pebble art. Pebble art is like an image, right, assembled from all those small, smooth rocks you find on a beach. So editing an assembly cut is like walking along the beach and collecting the prettiest pebbles you find in the sand. So if you give us 30 hours of footage in our assembly cut, we'll collect the best 100 minutes of footage. And then editing a rough cut involves arranging those pebbles into some kind of pretty preliminary design or structure. Normally both those cuts can take months to edit, but we accelerate the process.
That is phenomenal. It's wonderful. So what do you do with people who live out of town and want to work with you? Can you do this via electronically, Skype or some way where you send the files back and forth and work together?
Absolutely. Let me just clarify, New Doc Editing, we offer two services. One is story consulting, and that's usually I'm the story consultant weighing in on cuts. So, right, for example, just yesterday we received a rough cut from a filmmaker in Northampton, Massachusetts, and I asked for a low-res QuickTime file to download quickly so I can scrub back and forth through it. So most of our work both as story consultants and editors is done remotely, virtually. So when it comes to editing, we ask directors to ship us their drive with their project and footage. And then together we will collaborate to create these cuts. Usually there's two rough cuts. And the editor will send the cut to me and the director, and if they're working with an you know, somebody else on their editorial team, we'll all review that, and we'll get together on the phone and discuss what's working, because that's really important to know so you don't change it. And then we set about solving problems. And then by the end of those sessions, we come up with a prioritized list of editorial tasks for the next cut. So it works really well remotely. Occasionally when filmmakers are in the Bay Area, I will meet in person with them. I'm hoping to meet with Anita in the next couple of weeks. But this guy that sent me the rough cut yesterday, he said, "How important is it to meet in person?" And I said, "You know, to be honest, it can help emotionally if you're needing support, to just, you know, look in somebody's eyes." And I do kind of, like you, I think one of the ways I contribute is as an encouraging coach. But in terms of intellectually figuring out how to make the film work, I find the phone is better because people focus better.
How interesting. So, anyway. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, usually that's very true. When you get people on the phone, you have an outline, you go through the outline, cover anything else that comes up, and that's it. You're finished.
Mm-hmm.
But in person, it takes longer, and you get off track a lot, don't you? That's true.
It's true.
It's true. I hadn't thought about it.
It's usually not. Right, and it's not usually recorded, like this conversation is being recorded, and our consultations are recorded, so you can go back and listen to them.
Oh, how lovely. Yes, that would support the filmmaker for what did she say? And you don't have to take notes then, because they know they can go back, it's all there, and they can have their family and friends and crew listen to it. Yes, that's great.
Yeah, they're more present.
So you do story consulting and editing. Well, what about, I have a filmmaker that is a first-time filmmaker, and he made a film, and it's good. It's very good for a first-time filmmaker, I think. And the subject matter is most important. But now what we need is other people, of filmmakers, or editors, to look at it and say, you could make this film better by doing X, Y, and Z. Does your company do that?
Absolutely. That's the gist of story consulting. So this filmmaker you're talking about, is he editing his own film?
Yes. This is true.
Okay.
See, he shot it, he's editing it, and he's never done it before. So I just adore him, and the subject matter is most important. So I think that a good consultation or a good input could help him take it from where it is now to two or three times better.
I'm when I first started my business, I knew the value of story consulting from having needed it myself as a filmmaker. And I don't know about this filmmaker you're talking about, but my guess is that, like most filmmakers, at least one of his biggest problems is fundraising. And hiring, editing the film yourself is a great way to save money. And hiring a story consultant to help you edit is very important. I still hire story consultants to help me because we lose perspective.
Wow, you do. Good for you.
I do.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Okay, so that would be part of the story consult. Even though you've got it finished, you really can get it reviewed by a story consultant and get some input for improving it. That's great.
And they will get at least 7 pages of written notes, which are, there's usually 6 to 8 sort of headline comments about big issues like structure, and then dozens of detailed comments that are time code specific. And then I also offer a story consulting package where You get back a QuickTime file of your own film, and in the upper right-hand corner, you can see me commenting on the film, scene by scene, sometimes shot by shot. So you're getting sort of, you know, my first look at this film, and the first look only happens once, and that's what your viewers are going to get. So I'm giving feedback about not only what's working and what's got me on the edge of the seat, but where I'm confused or where I'm bored, and then, you know, we set about solving those problems. It's all solvable. So
oh,
that's
wonderful.
Very detailed feedback.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Well, is this outlined on your website?
Pardon me? Is this outlined on the website?
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yes,
okay,
absolutely.
Great. All right, then. Great,
and
thanks.
I guess I should mention the website. It's a...
Yes.
It's newdocediting.com. So new, N-E-W, doc, D-O-C, editing.com.
So the editing is usually the most expensive part of the documentary because it takes so long. Is that why?
Yeah, and because a lot of people try to save money by hiring editors that, well, that really aren't experienced and don't know how to tell a story. You know, since the nonlinear editing programs came out, and this tells people how old I am probably. Are you still there? Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. We can.
So I'm 57. I don't mind telling people. Anyway, anybody these days who can figure out how to operate Premiere or Final Cut Pro can call themselves an editor. And, you know, I guess you get what you pay for, and if you're paying one or two or $2,500 a week for an editor and it's taking a long time, you probably have an editor who doesn't have a lot of experience with feature documentaries and hasn't won awards and doesn't really know how to tell a story. So really a good way to save money in editing is to hire an editor who knows what they're doing. When people hire our editors, and I'm not coy about prices, it's $3,000 a week. They also get me as a story consultant for free. And so, you know, can do the math. We can finish the film in 10 weeks.
Wow, that is fast.
It is. And it's, you know, if you don't have $30,000, we have ways to work with you. So anyway, sure, I want to market my business, but I also, and this is one thing I learned from you, Carol, I want to be of service to people. I want to help solve problems. And I remember just an early phone call we had probably 6 years ago when I was trying to figure out my next film. And you were telling me about reaching some milestone birthday and about, I don't know if you remember this, about how it became so clear to you that what was important was being of service to filmmakers. And about that time in my life and business, I kind of switched from, oh, I have to be the greatest and being significant-oriented to being contribution-oriented. Yes, it's still we still need to be good at what we do, but for me the goal changed to when I finish a story consultation, I want to hear, oh, my God, this is so helpful. Thank you. And I do often, and it makes my day, and I'm sure you know that feeling.
Oh, yes, that's the best. That's it. That's what we're here for, I really believe. We're here to support and nurture each other. But you still have to eat. You have to have a car,
yes,
and all of these things. So it has to come with a balancing situation. But working in a balance in your life like that, where changing the whole attitude, moving over to the creative consciousness is what you've done. And that's where you can tap into the field, get your information, and help people and enjoy your life. So bravo, Karen. Great move, I think. That's what it's
tap
all about.
Tap into the field, baby.
That's what you want to do.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
I wanted to, sorry, you're probably going to prompt me to do this right now.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to offer anybody listening to this to get a free copy of my book, Documentary Editing. And the way to do that And it's a great way to sort of see if, you know, see if you want to work with me, but also just get a lot of tips about editing that we don't have time to discuss. Go to my website, newdocediting.com. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a place to put your name and email, and I'll send you an electronic version. Actually, you'll get automatically an electronic version of my book, which is 189 pages, has been critically acclaimed by a Harvard film professor, and lots of people have told me it's helpful. You'll also be on my mailing list. Occasionally, I send out a newsletter about trends in documentary filmmaking and tips. Also, if you don't mind, I'll just give people my email in case you want to reach out for a free story consultation.
Oh,
it's Karen, K-A-R-E-N, at newdocediting.com. Carol, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about making inspiring films. And I'm curious, what have you seen? What have you seen lately that has inspired you? Did you see RGB?
I haven't seen that. I like to go see him on the big screen. But I did see Mr. Rogers. I loved that.
Oh, I've heard that's a great film. I haven't seen it yet.
Yes, yeah. And yeah. Well, Faces, Places.
Artist's film.
Oh, that was the most soul-touching, most caring. Agnes is such an artist, and we're so lucky to have her in this world. She's in a mid-80s or something, and she's driving around in this van putting all these pictures on walls. And it's just so full of heart. I love that one.
Aww.
So how about you? What have you seen that like?
Well, those two you mentioned are on the top of my list right now, Faces, Places, and the Mr. Rogers one. I think what really touched me about RGB that I've heard about Mr. Rogers is that, first of all, they're without shying away from problems, they are inspiring films. And they also have a quality of, I've been blogging recently about integral filmmaking. And, mm-hmm. and the sort of short definition of that is documentaries that see things from multiple perspectives and ultimately can sort of reach across the aisle and heal the polarization that's going on, which is not just because we have Donald Trump as president. It's partly due to technology, where we get to curate our own news feeds. And you know, I recently started, I now read CNN and Fox News to kind of keep my finger on the pulse. But the thing about, I've heard this about Mr. Rogers and also RGB, is for example, Ginsburg has, while she's moved progressively to the left on the Supreme Court bench, she has deepened her friendship with Justice Anton Scalia, who's very conservative. Over 35 years, they've deepened this friendship. That's touching to me. And I think films that show that in some ways we live in different worldviews, we value different things, but if we can see, you know, if we're making a documentary about, say, climate change, if you use language that's not just about sustainability, but, you know, allow somebody to speak about being steward over the creator's creations, that's going to speak to somebody that it probably doesn't identify themselves maybe as progressive or liberal. So anyway, I could go on, but I love that you picked out those films, and my next blog is going to be about this, so stay tuned.
Okay, good. And if you want a good foreign film that really makes you think and take a look at the justice system, I think it's called Three Murders. It's a Japanese film about a murderer. And how he is handled in the justice system in Japan, which is very similar to ours. It's an incredibly well-made film. It may be up for some awards, I would think.
Did you see it in the theaters?
Yeah, yeah. We have up here Oxnard Film Society, and George runs it, and he gets us films from all over the world. And every Monday in the summertime, we get a film a week, and it's stupendous. You get to see films that you would probably have to get on Amazon or Netflix, but we see them in the theater with the perfect sound and beautifully screened.
And probably with some of the same people, so it sounds like a source of community.
Yes,
every week
it
you,
is.
You run into some of the same people. That's great.
Oh,
that's great.
Absolutely.
Do they have discussions after?
Yes, yes. They all meet in the restaurant afterwards to talk about it. So, and this is
great.
And they're sneaking in docs, which is great for me. I love it. It started out as features only, but he's been throwing in a doc here and there, and people are loving it. So he's getting more documentaries, and that's what it takes. People like that to move people over to show them that they're not boring. They can be totally interesting, totally enticing, and can make you feel good when you leave. And that's usually why people go to the theater.
Yeah, exactly. Who wants to go to a bummer documentary on a Thursday night? Filmmaker Magazine just announced there's a headline about this being the golden age of documentaries. And I remember that being said like 20 years ago. So I love that the genre is going strong. And for all the directors out there who are listening, I was once told this by an editor, and I want to share it because I really believe it, having made six of my own. It takes a lot of – directors of documentaries are courageous. John Elf at UC Berkeley used to say, you're doing God's work. And he didn't mean it in a strict religious sense. But, you know, it's hard. It is hard just to be an artist and then to be able to raise the money. And then, you know, you're exhausted after finishing the film and you've got to market it. But I just want to, you know, just stand with you, Carol, and just encourage – everybody who's listening to keep, you know, keep on keeping on.
That's
and
it.
You're doing something important.
Exactly. Yeah. And it'll benefit people for years to come. And you have no idea how many lives you can change with one documentary. It's wonderful. But speaking of that, you know, the biggest problem I have is editing trailers. Now, that is a talent. That is a separate talent than editing a film, in my opinion. You know, I look at trailers and I say, this is missing, that's wrong. And it's upsetting to me because I know that is the moneymaker. The trailer is the most important part of your fundraising. So have you got any tips for editing trailers?
Yes, and fundraising trailers are different than theatrical trailers when the film is done, but I would say some of the things that apply to both are number one, production values, meaning every shot should showcase high production values. You know, unless there's a huge plot point, like, you know, a murder, somebody's firing a gun, never include shots that are shaky or poorly lit. In a trailer, you want to feature your best material, and audio is actually more important than video. So don't include anything amateurish that would lead funders to think you're not a professional. Music, very important. Here's a couple do's and do nots. Do not use one piece of music as a bed throughout the entire trailer. Think about using at least two pieces of music. Usually about halfway through, there's going to be some shift in tone. Do use music intelligently for punctuation. So, for example, to transition from, one scene to another, take music away because that makes the point, and then bring it back in. That makes emphasis. Avoid music with lyrics. Usually for a fundraising trailer, it's okay to use music for which you don't currently have the rights. Narration in a trailer for documentaries, for fiction films, it's often voiceover. But for documentaries, it's usually text cards. And some of those text cards, you know, title cards should proclaim the director's credentials. Of course, structure is important. That's a big topic. But I actually wanted to ask you, Carol, the length of trailers of theatrical trailers has stayed about the same, around 2 minutes. Fundraising trailers, what is your sense of, say, for a crowdfunding, and we've done 6 together crowdfunding campaigns, what's your current advice on how long a trailer should be?
Well, this is being footballed all around the field here. Right now, Indiegogo says 2.20, no longer than that for a funding trailer. Now, see, I come from the place where I would watch a 4-minute trailer if it tells me a story and totally engages me. And what I have always felt is that a good funding trailer it's got to be under 5 minutes, that's for sure. But it could be 3.5 minutes, 4 minutes, but because you need that time to engage me and really tell me the story. That's all I care about, that we fund stories in our grants. And so I watch a trailer and I'll say, oh, my gosh, there's 30 seconds went to credits at the beginning. This is a trailer.
That's a big mistake. Good point.
Where's the story, you know? So that's all I'm looking at. What's the story and sound? I'm with you. That's more important than audio in a lot of cases. I want good sound, and I want, I'll put up with medium, not poor, but sort of medium video if I understand that they probably had the camera in their pocket or it was an impossible shot to get and yet they got it or whatever. Because if it works and shows me a story and keeps me into the film, I want to stay in the film and not be distracted. I know that's a lot to ask, but that's what I want. Because you have to leave me wanting more. That's the whole thing. I want to see you fund that film. And that's how you get to the top of my grant.
Yeah. On length, I have a slightly different opinion. And this comes from my experience. Like many busy people, you know, email takes a big chunk of my day. And if I see an email for a crowdfunding video, if I click on it and the video says 1:something, I'm likely to take the time to watch it. But if it's over 2 minutes and I'm feeling pressured and busy, I might leave it to watch later and I might never see it. So it's harder to cut something shorter, but I think it's I think you get some people, busy people that you might have lost otherwise.
Oh, you're so smart. Now, yes, because I'm watching it to, you know, to get the story. But if you can tell a story in 2 minutes or thereabouts, then you really have a winner.
Yeah. Yep. And not the whole story, of course. We don't want to give away the ending for a fundraising trailer.
I think there's still fundraising trailers, and then there's crowdfunding trailers. And the crowdfunding, you've got to be the sharp guys. So, you know, when they send me a 3 or 4 minute trailer, that's my job to watch it. I've even watched 10-minute trailers and liked it. But then I'm looking for more, I think. It depends on what you want. So I don't know. It seems somewhere I heard that you make a 10-minute trailer and then you have to cut it down because some grants want 5 minutes and then you've got your fundraising for 2:20 or 2 minutes or under. So how do you handle all those needs when you talk to people about giving them a trailer?
Yeah, good question. So for a lot of grants, they want to see not just a short trailer. They want to see 20 minutes of footage because a trailer won't show if you actually have the scenes, say, to create a character-driven story. So they want to see a 20-minute sample reel, and that's a different beast. And that could be like three scenes that show three different plot points. For a crowdfunding fundraising trailer,
I really like to see the trailer bookended by the filmmaker. So right away, I really want to see the filmmaker. I want to know who this person is. Do I like them? Do I resonate with them? Why do they care about this? And you can do that in 15 seconds. And then you have your trailer. And then at the end of that, here's a tip that I got from Maury Wachowski, who's written books about, say, house funding parties. And that is to, and this isn't a must, but it's a nice thing, to introduce somebody from your film and ask them to explain why the film is important briefly, say. So for a social issue documentary where you're trying to change something, somebody who is, say, I don't know, going into poor places and teaching kids how to use cameras, like Born into Brothels, have that person on screen and explain why they think the film is important. So you don't have to be the only one pitching your own film.
That's a very good idea. Yeah, I do too. That's brilliant. Well, actually, we're going to interview Maury next week. Did you know that?
Oh, that's great. No, I didn't. That's awesome. That'll be fun.
I really love fundraising trailers. I mean, I love fundraising parties. And so now I'll talk to him about the trailer. I'll get him to repeat that because this is the time between now and, I'd say Thanksgiving, a perfect time if you're working on a project to do a fundraising party because we've got summer and fall, and these are the times when people start to really open their hearts and their pocketbooks, and a good time to know that you're going to need a tax deduction and to go to that funding party.
Excellent. We edit trailers. We can usually do it in 4 days, sometimes five.
Great.
So, depending on how much footage you give us. So keep that in mind. It is
okay,
a good time.
Right.
It is definitely a good time.
And what's your next project? Have you got anything in mind?
For myself?
Yes.
A feature documentary? I'm just laughing because I feel like I have finally found I love making documentaries, but I feel like I've really found my groove, which is helping filmmakers with structure. And it's something I love, and I love to go deep into that. So no, I don't have a current personal film in mind, but I do know the kinds of films that I like to be part of. And, they're all along the project of uplifting humanity, as was the topic of the film I just finished, American Visionary, the story of Barbara Marx Hubbard, on the idea of, sort of consciously evolving and seeing our crises, of which there are plenty, as evolutionary drivers. That's the short answer. But thank you for asking.
Well, no, I think you're right. You just look at what you can do by helping people get their films finished in the best way possible, winning awards, getting it out, teaching them how to get into the audience, get their film made for their audience. That's so important. People forget that. They're making the film for their reasons, they think, but they also have to direct it towards an audience and find that audience. And I know you do that as part of your work, right? You bring out who this is.
Yes, yes. And you helped me really learn to drill down on that. Who is the person this film is being made for, and what problem are you solving? And that's part of the reason that the tagline of my business is keeping your viewers glued to the screen, not keeping you glued to the screen, but keeping your viewers glued to the screen. So we're always cognizant of how is this coming across to the audience and who is your audience. And you've really helped me clarify that.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, this has been an extraordinary conversation, and the information is outstanding and will benefit a lot of filmmakers, Karen. I sincerely thank you.
Oh, thank you, Carol. And I'm bookending this with I love you and thank you.
Very kind.
And, thumbs up to everybody listening. Keep on. You're getting there. Okay. Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Claire.
Okay.
Karen,
thank
I
you.
Have to let you know. I just Karen, I have to let you know. I went ahead and went to your website and I signed up to get your free PDF book. So I'm looking forward to it, and I just want to remind the listeners that if you're interested as well in Karen's book, it's on film editing, correct?
Right.
The one that you were talking about. Yes, film documentary editing. And so once again, will you give your website address so that they know where to go to sign up for that?
Yes, it's newdoc.com. Newdocediting.com.
Thank you, Claire. Okay. Lots of love, Karen.
Thanks. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Thank you.
Be well, everyone.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice, fair use, successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com.
Carol and I sincerely thank you for all that you do as our listeners, for joining us on the show, for sending in ideas for topics and things that you would like to hear about, and also for the donations that you offer at FromTheHeartProductions.com. We urge you to continue to send us your ideas for more shows, and also send heartfelt thanks to everyone for all the good that has come from these many years that we've been doing these shows. And we'll see you next week at our next podcast with Maury Warshawski.
I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.